You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Children's Voices on War and Peace was produced by Nathan Thompson and Sonali Kalhatar at KPFK Radio. It's a documentary that features Charlotte Albadron and many other young children speaking out against war and about the consequences of war on children. Charlotte Albadron recently gained fame on the Internet when her essay on the American flag was posted to the Common Dreams website. She's a 12-year-old who attends Cunningham Middle School in Presque Isle, Maine. She recently gave a speech to over 3,000 people at a peace rally in Maine on October 26, where she challenged adults to hear the voices of children hurt by war in Afghanistan, Palestine, Israel, and Iraq. Charlotte's brave voice adds urgency to a growing awareness among youth about the consequences of a war against Iraq.
I've been speaking up a lot since September 11th. On February 12th, I wrote an essay for school saying that we care more about the American flag than about living up to what it stands for. On March 22nd, I told Senator Stowe's staff in Presque Isle that you grown-ups were being hypocrites because you tell kids to solve problems with words while you kill people in Afghanistan. On March 28th, I said the same thing to Senator Collins in person. She told me that because we invaded Afghanistan, little girls can go to school and learn to read. Some choice, learn to read or have a mom and a dad. On April 3rd, the Common Dreams website posted my flag essay. It got lots of attention and was reprinted and read on the radio. I got 800 emails. I was surprised to get such a response because I'd started to believe that solving problems by talking was something only kids had to do, but that grown-ups could fight all they wanted. Like they get to drink and swear, but kids can't. On May 12th, I spoke at the peace rally in Bath. On May 20th, I talked to Shelley Pingree and Tom Daschle. I suspected that Tom Daschle was not paying attention because, with a glazed look in his eyes, he stuffed my flag essay in his pocket, unread. On June 22nd, I spoke at the Maine Green Independent Party convention. Now, here it is, October 26th, and I'm giving another speech. That's a really bad sign, because it means we still don't have peace. In fact, we're about to go and kill even more people. Well, I'm getting a little sick of hearing my own voice. Hello, is anyone out there listening? I guess my voice is too small to make a difference. So this time, I'll add the voices of other children, and maybe together we'll be loud enough. Children like Allie, who was 3 when we killed his father in the Gulf War. Allie scraped at the dirt covering his father's grave every day for 3 years, calling out to him. It's all right, Daddy. You can come out now. The men who put you there have gone away. And Lue, who was 11 at the time, and was glad he didn't have to go to school or do homework. He went to bed and got up whenever he felt like it, but today he has no education and still hears the explosions in his head. And the children in Basra, southern Iraq, who today play in the dust while air raid sirens scream around them because we keep dropping bombs. And all the children in Iraq who will never grow up because they have leukemia and cancers from the depleted uranium in our missiles. And they can't get any drugs or radiation treatment because we won't let their country have them. I don't know the names of all these children. Can you hear our voices yet? I'll add 10-year-old Mohobola in Afghanistan, who was out collecting firewood for his family when he found one of those bright yellow soda can-sized cluster bomblets with parachutes. What child could resist? He ended up with mangled flesh where his left hand used to be. President Bush asked each American child to give a dollar to help Afghani children. Here's my dollar's worth. It is the voice of 6-year-old Palika, was carried to the hospital still wearing her party dress from the wedding we bombed for 2 hours, killing her whole family by mistake. And 2-year-old Aliha, who was dug out of the rubble where her family was crushed when we blew up their village. Again, by mistake. Afterward, our soldiers said they were sorry. Among themselves, they called the Afghans ragheads. Like I said in my flag essay, we are better at caring about symbols than real people. Can you hear us yet? Our government is paying for educational theater in Afghanistan that teaches kids to fight with pen and paper, not guns, and tells them to, quote, join the educated culture of the world, unquote. They call it the mobile mini circuits for children. The performers are orphans who live just north of Kabul in an orphanage filled with 2,000 victims of our airstrikes, our greed, our comfort. When are we going to join the educated cultures of the world? Maybe you'll hear the voices of Palestinian children. Sammy, shot in the head by an Israeli soldier the day before his 12th birthday. 10-year-old Reham, killed in her schoolyard by an Israeli tank shell. And 14-year-old Faris, who told his 8-year-old brother, Abdel, to go home when he followed him out to buy groceries. Abdel refused, so he got to see the tank shoot his brother dead in the street. And the 6 Matar children, ages 2 months to 17 years, all killed when an Israeli pilot flying an American-made jet dropped a 1-ton bomb on their home. The pilot was sent by an Israeli Prime Minister, Ariel Sharon, who our president calls a man of peace. Can you hear us yet? How about the voices of Israeli children, like 14-year-old Raya and 2-year-old Hamza, killed with their parents by a Palestinian suicide bomber when they went out to eat pizza? 9-month-old Avia, killed by Palestinians who shot and threw grenades at cars. And the 12 teenagers killed by a suicide bomber at a nightclub. Can you hear us now? How many more children must suffer or die before you hear us? No offense, but I really don't want to have to make another peace speech ever again.
Charlotte's Voice. Thanks to Nathan Thompson and Sonali Kalhatar from KPFK in Los Angeles for that piece. Nowadays, the Bush administration, Congress, analysts and protesters of a war against Iraq have been discussing the issues involved in today's build-up for a war against Iraq. In the UN Security Council, the UK supports Bush's war in Iraq, while France opposes a unilateral action and requests that the arms inspection team be given a chance. But what is the history of the relationship between Europe, Iraq, and the USA? A 2-year investigation called Hidden Wars of Desert Storm brings us some of the answers, dating back to 1920.
In the 1920s, European and American oil companies discover and begin to exploit the first oil fields in the Middle East. The potential of these fields would become particularly critical to oil-poor Western Europe. The profit margins are huge, while the cut to local regimes is minimal, and the price of oil at the well is almost the same as mineral water. World War II changes this equation. Despite their victory over Nazi Germany, both France and England are gravely debilitated and begin losing their grip over their former colonies. In the Middle East, new leaders come to power, removing monarchies no longer protected by the former colonial forces and swept away by popular revolutions. However, The British and French role in the Middle East is now being taken over by the big winner of the war, the United States of America. Despite its own oil resources, the U.S. comes to realize the strategic importance of the Middle East oil. To contain the Soviet Union, to rebuild Western Europe, and to confirm the American industrial boom. But Washington hopes to maintain the inexpensive Middle East oil bonanza of before World War II. The new Middle East regimes think otherwise. And when they seek to retake control of their own national wealth, it strikes a chord of panic in Washington, London, and Paris. It is war against Egypt when Nasser seizes the Suez Canal. In Iran, Mossadegh nationalizes oil fields and kicks the British oil companies out. He is subsequently ousted by a CIA-orchestrated coup that puts the Shah back in command. In Iraq, as General Abdel Karim Qassem takes over and nationalizes the oil fields, the West cries, communism.
Ahmed al-Bayati, Iraqi opposition delegate in London.
Saddam came to power in 1968. This coup came as a result of an oil deal between Iraq and French company IRAB. This contract upset the West in general and the Americans in particular, so they encouraged a coup in Iraq at that time.
The United States has had sort of a love-hate relationship with Saddam Hussein, which is not something that a lot of people in this country are aware of.
International arms trade analyst Bill Hartung.
But going back to the late 50s and early 60s when the CIA actually supported Saddam Hussein and his Ba'ath Party in the coup that brought him to power.
Former Iraqi oil minister Fidel Chalabi.
The vice prime minister Ba'ath, called As-Sadi, said in a book which he published in Beirut that we, the Ba'athists, came to power in an American train. He said that.
Despite his already well-known ruthlessness, Saddam Hussein remains the good guy of the West until 1972. This year, the OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, agrees to raise the price of the barrel from $3 to $22. Iraq follows suit and nationalizes its oil fields. Saddam is then deemed unreliable by Washington, and as a result, branded a terrorist leader. The U.S. then shifts all of its support to its long-standing ally in the region, the Shah of Iran.
Ramsey Clark.
For 25 years, from 1953, the Shah of Iran was the U.S. surrogate in the Persian Gulf and Middle East region. The U.S. sold him about $22 billion in arms from 1972 to 1976. The Shah was our man.
The hope of control by the West of the Middle East fades in 1979 when the Shah is overthrown by anti-Western fundamentalist leader Ayatollah Khomeini. By then, Saddam Hussein becomes again a viable card in Washington's hand. He becomes the actual president of Iraq after 11 years of being its vice president, and then perpetrates a sweeping purge of his opponents and attacks Iran without provocation or apparent reason.
Bill Hartung.
The Stockholm Peace Research Institute has found that 52 different countries supplied weapons to Iran or Iraq, and 29 countries supplied both sides. So the very same countries that were saying how horrible the war was were using that war to stimulate their arms industries, to test some of their new weapons designs.
David Welch, U.S. Department of State.
We did have some very limited engagement with the government of Iraq, actually a lot less so than other governments. And both protagonists were under arms embargoes during that period, arms embargoes that the United States, for its part, did not violate.
Bill Hartung.
The United States was perhaps the most hypocritical of the countries that supplied arms for the war, because its public position was, we're not going to arm Iran, we're not going to arm Iraq, when quietly, secretly, they were actually arming both sides of the conflict.
Saddam Hussein's ambition, however, is to develop Iraq's own non-conventional mass destruction weapons. An inquiry conducted by the U.S. Congress in 1992 reveals the American contribution to this effort is quite significant as well, and fully monitored by the CIA and the U.S. State Department, whose reports as early as the late 70s have been detailing the extent of Iraq's mass destruction weapon programs and its repetitive use of chemical weapons against Iranian troops and Kurdish opponents.
David Welch, U.S. Department of State.
In 1988, we had no idea that Saddam Hussein would be using chemical weapons on his own people. If we had known all this in advance, we would have made our policy quite a bit different in 1988, I'm sure.
Voices start being heard within the U.S. government asking about the wisdom of giving Iraq huge credits intended for purchasing U.S. agricultural goods, but used instead to buy helicopters, armored trucks, unreasonable amounts of pesticides, germs, and advanced arms-making technologies. The U.S. State Department and the White House under Presidents Reagan and then Bush systematically quell all the inquiry attempts from Congress and the Treasury Department. From massive arms purchases to the development of costly military research programs, Saddam Hussein has ruined formerly rich Iraq.
Hidden Wars of Desert Storm is based on documents never before seen on television, backed by hours of interviews with U.S. Army commanders, arms inspectors, and U.N. team leaders on Iraq issues. The Defense Department is planning a preemptive strike on Iraq that might cause collateral damage. Well, that doesn't sound too bad, but what if we said the Department of War is launching a first strike on Iraq that will cause the deaths of thousands of innocent women and children? The Bush administration and the corporate media seem to be developing a language reminiscent of Orwellian newspeak in order to sanitize the horrors of war. I spoke to media critic Norman Solomon in our Pacifica studio and asked him how a war on Iraq is being marketed to the American people.
It really seems that the more brutal the U.S. military actions are, the more euphemistic the description is. And we can look back to half a century ago when war became defense. And so a lot of times even progressives kind of get sucked into that whole nomenclature game when we say we're against the defense budget. Well, that's what the government calls it. They say there's a defense department with a defense budget. It really is, of course, a war department with a war budget. And personally, I would be in favor of spending for defense. Unfortunately, the billions and billions of dollars pumped into military armaments has little or nothing to do with genuine defense.
Mm-hmm. Of course, when you say defense as opposed to war, who can argue that?
It's absolutely justifiable as a self-justifying word. Unfortunately, we have just such an enormously aggressive history that has a lot of blood flowing as a result in the past and in the present, and unless we're able to stop it, in the future.
Mm. Using the word defense also sort of plays right into the Christian theological doctrine that uses defense as part of the definition for a so-called just war. If you're going to have, there are some wars that the Catholic Church, the Baptist Church, etc., that the whole Christian theology will accept as a so-called just war. And the criteria for that is that you are defending yourself. So by using the word defense and defense department, defense budget, etc., it just sort of really, it allows itself to be justified.
I think that's very true. And we have now the intersection between, more than ever, Pennsylvania Avenue and Madison Avenue, so that as all of this is presented as being just inherently justifiable to mobilize the Pentagon to launch missiles into heavily populated areas, whether in Afghanistan or Iraq or Yugoslavia, there also is this notion that the packaging is the reality. And so what better process than to turn our TV screens into video games, and of course the games need captions. Mm-hmm. So in the late 1980s, the invasion of Panama, so-called Operation Just Cause, and then Desert Shield and Desert Storm in 1990 and 1991 with the U.S. first sending in troops. And who can be against Operation Desert Shield? Just a shield sounds very mm-hmm. defensive. And then likening the horrific launching of missiles and dropping of bombs into heavily populated areas in Iraq during the Gulf War, likening it to a natural, perhaps God-ordained occurrence, Desert Storm. Mm-hmm. Even now, people talk about it. Often the word is even excluded. It's just Desert Storm, and that would seem to indicate that people like Colin Powell or Dick Cheney or Bush, the elder or the younger, are somehow almost messengers or assistants to the Lord, which would fit into the point that you're making again.
Well, I mean, you know, it's all a lot more palatable to the American public if you don't have to really say words like war and casualties and deaths. How many deaths were there today and bombs? And you can just look at the TV and see just lights and, you know, that represent deadly missiles. And you're so far emotionally removed from the whole horrors of war when you reduce it to these kind of terms. Another one of those terms would be collateral damage, which i.e. dead women and babies and innocent civilians who have been caught in the crossfire, basically.
Absolutely. The sense that a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down. A lot of the euphemisms, the fogging, it's what the psychiatrist Robert J. Lifton has called psychic numbing. We, the U.S. government, whatever terminology you use, our society countenances, pays for, done with our tax dollars in our names. We are numbing ourselves to not feel those realities. And part of the mass media function in serving what's been called the military-industrial media complex is to further numb us, to detach us, to look at the TV and blips on a screen are presented as missiles and also to represent human beings. I mean, pixels are not human beings.
What about connecting the dots? We it's our feeling that, you know, when the average listener or participant in one of these peace marches comes back home and turns on the TV and sees that no local TV stations were there to even cover the event when you had 100,000 plus people in your city. And they start to wonder, why would they ignore such a major event? And oftentimes we've suggested that, you know, it's not in their interest, corporate speaking, corporate-wise, to do so. Can you help us connect the dots between some of these mega corporations and multimedia operations?
I suppose you could say that the main purpose of mass media is not to make sense nearly as much as it is to make money. And oftentimes people become radicalized and come to denounce the patterns of mass media coverage and lack of coverage on various issues because it's about something that they're familiar with. When you know about an issue, when you've been somewhere at an event and you see either the non-coverage or the distorting coverage, that makes people angry. And it should, because if the body politic needs a circulatory system, so to speak, that is the news media. And when there's that kind of blockage that's going on time after time, we become very ill. I think clearly as a society, as Martin Luther King said, when you spend so much money on the guns, you don't even have the bucks for oleo. I mean, we are seeing now our own country being bled dry of the basics of health care, nutrition, housing, and education. And talk about connecting the dots. Activists at the grassroots dealing with all kinds of issues from health care to the environment to human rights to education know full well that the absence of basic funding for those human needs is having a devastating effect on our own communities. And yet national media, those are dots they don't want to connect. They're talking about spending $100 billion a year to bomb Iraq, while in our own neighborhoods, people are suffering through lack of basic human services.
Mm-hmm. You know, I heard a reporter doing a stand-up last week, and he got ready to lock out, and he said something like, for CBS or NBC, CNBC, you know, and he had to really go through about a list of about three or four different media operations that he was actually connected with. And it was just hilarious. I mean, but it was scary at the same time.
It is. It's tough to satirize. Yeah. There's, you know, Disney, Fox, MSNBC, General Electric. What is a joke? One year maybe reality the next mm-hmm. after the next merger.
So Mickey Mouse is running the whole media
conglomeration
in this country.
When Jim Hightower, who was working for ABC when it was owned by Cap Cities, and then right after General Electric, or rather, and I get these confused here, after Disney bought mm-hmm. ABC, he went on his next national radio show and said, "Folks, now I work for a rodent," meaning Mickey Mouse. Of course, he was out the door pronto.
I'm sure. Norman Solomon, media critic and executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy. The major TV networks are all owned by large corporations with ties to the war industry. NBC is owned by General Electric, which is one of the top 10 military contractors. CBS is owned by Viacom. ABC is owned by Disney. CNN is owned by AOL Time Warner. The members of the board of directors of these powerful corporations also sit on the boards of weapons manufacturers. Well, as thousands came out last night to celebrate Halloween in New York City, many were wore costumes meant to send a political message. Julie Hay was there and files this report.
The streets of New York were packed last night as thousands came out to celebrate Halloween. Betsy was at the parade with the radical cheerleaders and says that her soldier costume provoked some confused stares, but also many nods of encouragement as she rode to work on the subway.
I'm wearing a pair of army fatigues that I bought at a thrift store. I'm wearing a patch that says Fighter for Texaco and another patch that says Fighter for Power. And I'm wearing a piece of duct tape with an American flag over my mouth and the word expendable written across my face in black eyeliner.
What were you last year?
I was Pippi Longstocking last year. It's my first political costume.
I'm going as Uncle Sam. I'm wearing a Stars and Stripes top hat with flashing stars and a death mask, and I'm carrying an inflatable globe. I'm not anticipating any trouble, but I understand that there are representatives of various nations that would like to share the globe, and it's my intention to make sure that they don't get it.
Maya Cash from the Billionaires for Bush's War was at the parade wearing a fur coat and a crown.
We just came back from a counter-protest in Washington, D.C., where we explained to everyone that war may not be wise for people and living things, but it's certainly a wise investment.
I am a primitive. I like war. War, 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 war. Bush, boom, bomb, bomb, boom, Bush. More war, more war.
The warmongering caveman was part of a contingent that paraded behind a banner that read, "An absurd response to an absurd war." Also part of that contingent was a representative from the Inter-Ocean Pirate Organization, who carried a sign that read, "Pirates for Global Booty."
See, we hear that there's rum in Iraq, and currently there's a rum shortage. So we're advocating that all the pirates of the world unite to go into Iraq to get the rum that's there.
Okay. We are the missile chicks, and we're wearing strap-on silver missiles.
With little American flags on them.
And anywhere there's oil or natural gas, we go.
That's
and we'll
right.
kill for it. We're proud to be American. We'll kill.
And nobody's taking away our Cadillacs.
Pacifica's Peace Watch. Today's Peace Watch was produced by Laurel Padgett-Seekins and Scott Gurian, engineered by Granger Helvey, consultants Larry Binsky and Sam Husseini, editor Reem Kathuda. We had help from David Russo of the Indy Media Center of Washington, D.C., Mango and Tom Gomez of WBIX. We had assistance from Sidrak Franklin and Jabari Zakia of WPFW. We had web help from Pete Karakis and RadioForAll.net. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Thank you for listening. We'll